God. Ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at CITR.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Tonight, we take pleasure in bringing you Suspense, a weekly anthology of notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense.
Hey, Kat.
Can't sleep, huh?
Yeah.
Don't blame you. It's a sultry night, as our friends down south would put it.
And my bedroom fan is on the fritz.
Ugh, sorry.
Eh. Wasn't helping much anyway. Like a spoon stirring a bowl of hot soup.
Evocative.
My English teacher would be so pleased.
What time is it?
3:33.
Ooh, scary.
Huh?
Oh, you know the old wives' tale about how all sorts of scary things are supposed to be afoot at 3:33, right?
Scary things afoot? If we're talking about goblins and demons and such, wouldn't they be a hoof?
Yeah, I guess they would be at that.
Besides, isn't it 3 a.m. that's supposed to be evil?
3 a.m. is the devil's hour. The opposite of 3 p.m., the hour in which Christ was supposed to have been crucified. But I think there's some sinister significance to 3:33, too.
Well, I'll take your word for it.
Hey, why not sit down, take a load off? There's a little bit of a breeze. Maybe the night air will relax you enough that you can get back to sleep.
I'll try.
You don't sound too optimistic.
I have to get up at 6:30 anyways to get ready for school. So, even if I go back to bed, I'll probably just lay there, looking at the clock, every 5 minutes.
Couldn't hurt to try, though. You want to be fresh in the morning, especially for that trigonometry final.
It's no use.
Why so certain?
Because right around 4 a.m. is when everyone in the whole neighborhood starts making noise.
Really? I never noticed.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Who the heck is up at 4 a.m.? It's not like we're on a farm here.
Well, first up will be Old Man Mitchum.
The milkman?
Yep. He's out there banging around 3 mornings a week. He does 1/3 of the houses on the block Monday, 1/3 of them on Wednesday, and 1/3 of them on Friday. Because clearly it would make too much sense just to knock out the whole street in one morning.
And that's a problem.
Yes, because he parks his milk truck at the end of the block and pushes that little cart of his up and down the street. And every time he hits a crack in the sidewalk, the bottles get to clinking against each other. Ugh! It's so annoying.
Hey, at least he doesn't come around for the empties on Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Don't give him any ideas.
Well, what about catching a few winks after Milkman Mitchum is done making the rounds?
No dice, because that's when Tommy Hellwig starts his paper route.
Ugh, that kid. You mean the one who bounces the newspaper off the siding right under your bedroom window every single morning?
That's him.
Does he have a crush on you or something?
Ew! Earwig? No.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure. Why would you think that little creep likes me?
Well, because boys will often do the most annoying things imaginable to girls whom they are attracted to.
So you're saying Tommy Earwig is showing how much he likes me by waking me up at 5 a.m.?
I know it sounds crazy, but it could be his way of letting you know he's going by and thinking of you.
You're right.
You really think so?
No, I mean, it does sound crazy.
Do you have a better explanation?
Yes! He's mad at me for shoving a branch into his bicycle spokes and making him wreck.
When did you do that?
I haven't. Yet. But I consider doing it every morning at 5 o'clock.
I don't think that counts.
Fine. Say Earwig really does like me. Do boys ever grow out of this sort of behavior?
Sure. When they hit 90 or so.
I'm being serious.
And you think I'm not?
Maybe my mom's right about having me become a nun.
I think you'd have to become a Catholic first.
Minor point.
Okay, well, Tommy Hellwig will wake you up at 5. But that still gives you 90 minutes afterwards before you have to get up for school.
Unfortunately, 5:15 is when Mr. Garibaldi gets up.
The old fella next door? What about him?
He says that for a healthy garden and lawn, you gotta water way before dawn. That way, the ground has lots of time to absorb it all before the sun evaporates it.
Which means,
he gets up at 5 and is out squirting everything with a hose by a quarter after. I can hear it now. The squeaky faucet opened extra slow because he thinks then no one will hear it.
But that just makes it last even longer.
And then Mr. Garibaldi, squirting everything within 20 feet, including the side of our house, because he's trying to read the newspaper at the same time.
But how can he even see? It's still pitch black out.
He tries to read it by the street light.
Oh, I can bet that goes well.
Uh-huh.
So how long does this go on?
Till 5:35. Then Mr. Garibaldi walks over to the squeaky faucet and turns it off very slowly.
So that no one will hear it.
But of course.
I'm seeing a pattern here. So, who's up next?
Mrs. Dudley, across the street.
Oh, yeah. She drives that old Nash Metropolitan, doesn't she?
The one with the rusty hinges on the driver's side door, you mean?
And the starter trouble.
She leaves for work at the coffee shop every morning at 5:45. And every morning, it's the same thing. Squeak! Squeak! Bam!
Till finally, it turns over.
And then the fan belt starts squealing. And then she's off.
And by then, it's almost 6. Barely enough time for a quick nap.
Except, that's when Mom gets up, since she's gone to bed at 8:30 the night before.
And she's not the sort to patter around the house, quiet as a church mouse.
Nope. Clomping footsteps, cupboard door slamming, pots and pans clattering.
And she doesn't even cook. Oy. Here, why don't you have one of Mom's smokes?
A cigarette? Why on earth would I want one of those?
Well, she says they help her relax. And you could sure use something to help you relax.
Yeah, but I'm only 16.
So? Is there a minimum age requirement for stress? Besides, didn't she tell you once that she started smoking when she was even younger than you are?
She did. But I don't think that was meant to be encouragement.
Ah, one cig won't kill you. And if it might help you sleep a little, it's worth a shot.
Well,
they're menthols.
Okay.
First, you gotta puff on it to keep it going. And make sure to breathe it in. Don't just hold the smoke in your mouth, or it won't do you any good. You'll get used to it. Is it helping?
Yes. I think so.
Good. So, is there anything besides the sweltering night that's keeping you up?
Oh. Nothing out of the ordinary.
You sure about that?
Well,
hey, if you can't tell me, who can you tell?
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Well?
I'm having trouble at school.
But not with your grades. I mean, those are always good.
No, not with my grades.
Which leaves one other option. What's her name? And do you want me to knock her block off?
It's not just one girl. It's all of them.
How could you possibly have made every girl at school mad at you? You don't bother anybody. Heck, you barely talk to anybody.
I know. My whole existence at Harpersburg High centers around doing my work and staying out of trouble. If I can get through a day without drawing attention to myself, it's a good day.
But now you've drawn attention to yourself.
Not through anything I've actually done, but yes.
Okay. What happened?
You know Jessica Brody, right?
The queen of Harpersburg High? Yeah.
Well, her boyfriend has been... He likes me.
Oh.
And I have no idea why. It's not like I've ever encouraged him. I barely even made eye contact with him.
Hey, you don't have to explain to me. I know you better than anyone.
But last week, he started showing an interest in me.
Not that hard to understand. Have you looked in a mirror lately?
I try not to.
Look, just because you're in denial about what an attractive young woman you're becoming doesn't mean everyone else is.
I'm not in denial. I just don't see it as all.
Well, it seems like you're the only one who doesn't.
Could we please drop this?
All right. So, what happened with what's his name?
Jeff. Jeff Novak.
So what happened with Jeff? Jeff Novak?
At first, I didn't think anything of it. He'd just say hi to me in the hallways when he saw me. But then, he started slipping me notes during European history.
What did he write?
Anyway, one of Jessica's friends...
Suck-ups, you mean?
...caught him doing it. And Jessica's had it out for me ever since.
Has she tried to pick a fight with you?
Not yet. At first, it was just snotty remarks in the hallway. But then, her friend started bumping into me in the hall, making me drop my books.
Oh, accidentally, of course.
So they say. Then yesterday, I heard two of them talking about how they're all going to get me after school today.
Maybe they wanted you to overhear that, just to put a scare into you.
Well, if that was their intention, it worked. I'm afraid to even go to school now, but I have finals. I can't very well not go.
And that's why they chose today, because they knew for sure you'd be there.
What am I going to do, Kat?
Why not reason with Jessica? Go to her and say, look, I know you think I'm trying to steal your boyfriend, but I'm really quite happy with Tommy Earwig.
I'm glad you find this amusing anyway.
Far from it. Anything that affects you affects me too. But I'm not one to run.
So what do you think I should do?
What you were going to do anyway. Go to school and ace your finals.
What if they weren't just trying to scare me? What if they really do jump me after school?
Then you let them know they were in a fight. Take your lumps and file the whole thing away for future reference.
That doesn't sound like much of a plan.
That's all I've got. Losers like that don't deserve any more thought than that from us.
Maybe I should tell one of my teachers.
Tell them what? You don't know that those girls weren't just trying to put a scare into you. And maybe they were even trying to see what you'd do. Go running to your teacher, and not only will you lose any chance of ever getting some respect from them, you may precipitate the very beating you're afraid of.
So I should do nothing?
No. You should do what you were planning to do before you overheard those girls.
Okay.
Seems like that's not the only thing on your mind.
It's not.
So, what else is bugging you? Well?
It's work.
What could be the matter at work? Stocking shelves is not exactly rocket science.
Mr. Crossley asked me to stay after closing tomorrow to help him with inventory.
So? It's extra hours, which means more money you can sock away for college. And it's not like you had some hot date lined up, right?
That's not the point.
Then what is?
Normally, Mr. Crossley has two or three of us stay to do inventory. I asked around. No one is staying late but me. He didn't even ask anyone else.
Meaning? Oh. No. Really?
Really.
So you think that he... No! Oh, he's like 60 years old. And married.
I keep catching him staring at my... When I'm stocking shelves. Especially the lower ones.
I get you. Is he just looking? Or has he done more than look?
Well, He started hugging me when I'm ready to leave work. It's gotten bad enough that I try to slip out, but he always seems to catch me. He always does it when no one else is around.
Has he tried to touch you?
No. But he holds on to the hugs for too long. It feels creepy.
If it feels creepy, then you should go with that feeling. And you shouldn't be alone with him anymore. Have you talked with your mom about this?
No. I'm too ashamed.
Why? You've done nothing to be ashamed of.
I know. But talking about anything with her is hard enough, let alone something like this. Anyway, it wouldn't do any good. Even if I told her that Mr. Crossley was...
putting the moves on you.
Yeah. That. Even if I told my mom that, she'd say it was my fault.
How in the heck could it be your fault?
You know how she is. I can count the number of times she's let me wear makeup on one hand. And heaven forbid my knees ever show.
Yeah, that woman really has some issues.
If I told her about Mr. Crossley, my mom would say it was my fault for being flirtatious and dressing like a call girl.
Does she even have any idea what an actual call girl would wear?
It doesn't matter. I'm not talking to her about it at any event.
So, what are you going to do about old man Crossley?
What can I do?
Well, for one thing, there's no way you're doing inventory alone with him.
But if I don't, I might lose my job.
So what? Even in a town this small, there are other jobs.
Yeah, but Mr. Crossley is in the Chamber of Commerce. If he tells other business owners that I'm a bad employee...
Versus what? If you stay and do inventory alone with him, it'll get around. And then other business owners will want to hire you for reasons that have nothing to do with your work ethic.
Cat!
Oh, sakes alive. What are you doing up at this hour?
Oh, hi, Mom. I couldn't sleep.
Well, you should at least try. Catherine Mae West, what are you doing with that cigarette?
You said that cigarettes help you relax, and I was hoping it would work for me.
Young lady, if you want something that'll put you to sleep, you make yourself a glass of warm milk. And stay out of my cigarettes. Do I make myself clear?
Sorry, Mom. It's just that...
I asked you a yes or no question. And if the answer is no, you'll find you're not too old for me to tan your bottom. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, ma'am.
Now off to bed with you. And no more back talk.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, and Catherine, when I came out onto the porch, it sounded like you were having a conversation. Who with?
No one, Mom.
But I heard you call someone Cat. That used to be your nickname when you were a little girl, you know.
Yes. I was just talking to myself is all.
Well, cut it out. You'll go nuts doing that.
Yes, ma'am. Good night.
Good night.
That used to be your nickname when you were a little girl, you know. Oh, and that's just how she treats you.
Yeah, like I'm still a little girl.
But you're not a little girl. You're a grown woman who deserves some respect.
That's right.
But your mom, your ignorant neighbors, Jessica Brody and all those girls at school, that dirty old man Crossley, this whole stinking town, they're not going to give it to you. So you're going to have to take it. Or better still, take something else from them.
Like what?
You still have those matches, right?
Yeah. Why?
Catherine, Harpersburg is the most insignificant blot that has ever existed on the globe, full of petty, small-minded fools who wind their way through life like so many ants, searching for a crumb of food. Not one person outside of it would mourn its passing, or even notice that it was gone.
What are you saying, Kat?
I'm saying that you should do it a favor and put it out of its misery.
Meaning?
Burn it. Burn it all.
What?
Harpersburg. Burn it to the ground.
Burn it to the ground.
Every last bit of it. Why not?
Because...
You'll need that can of gasoline from the garage. You know, the one for the mower?
Yeah.
Get that. And any old rags you can find. And the bottles you've been saving for the deposit...
So ends 333 by John C. Alcidek and Dana Perry Hayes. Tonight's story of suspense. Suspense is produced by Blue Hours Productions and recorded at Melrose Music in Hollywood, California. Tonight's radio drama was written especially for Suspense by John C. Alcidek and Dana Perry Hayes. Kate Scott was Catherine, Susan Eisenberg was Kat, and Dana Perry Hayes was Mom. I'm John C. Alcidek. Next week at this time, tune in again for another study in Suspense.
Radio show
is brewed fresh and served fresh at the peak of its flavor. If you're a tough customer, only the taste of this
radio show
will do. So go ahead, let Dunkin' Donuts make your
radio experience
exquisite
indeed.
Dunkin's Donuts, serving sweet treats from the pop underground. Thursdays, noon to one.
Estorino's is located off Commercial Drive in the heart of East Vancouver. It's run by the Britannia Community Center and is available to rent for anyone. Some of its features include tall ceilings, wood floors, accessible bathrooms, a stage, and a PA. Estorino's is an accessible space and centrally located. It's ideal for any type of rehearsal, information session, dance classes, arts and crafts sales, rummage sales, community events, and of course, shows and dancing.
Check out BritanniaCenter.org and the Facebook search Astorinos, or contact Maddie Harris by email at maddiefromlife@gmail.com to learn more.
Tonight, we take pleasure in bringing you Suspense. A weekly anthology of notable melodramas from stage and screen, fiction and radio, presented each week to bring you to the edge of your chair, to keep you in suspense.
Apparently, I have committed the perfect crime. I can say the murder was justified, which it most assuredly was, if murder ever is. I can rationalize it as I will, but the fact remains that I have deliberately taken the life of a fellow man. I think I know what the Black Madonna would say if she could speak. For after a fashion, she has spoken. The first time I ever heard of the Black Madonna was when Aunt B sent me a cryptic, somehow vaguely alarming note.
Paul, darling, I'm about to die a violent death. The Black Madonna says so, and you know, of course, that she is never wrong. Could you run up here for a few days, and not a word to Etienne about this when you arrive? Won't you please come, Paul? I'm frightened.
I hadn't seen Aunt B since her return from France, where she'd been trapped for years by the war. But just as usual, she took it for granted that I'd know just what she was talking about. But I didn't. What did she mean about dying a violent death? And who was the Black Madonna? And who in the hell was Etienne? Though knowing Aunt B, I could take a guess as to the latter. Anyway, I shut up shop immediately and drove north along the coast highway, then negotiating the tricky mountain roads to her place, La Casa Encantada.
Hello? Aunt B?
Paul, sweet. I knew you'd come to see me before I get hit by a truck or fall off a cliff or whatnot. Have a piece of toast, lover. Isn't this weather gorgeous? Oh, that's a handsome tie. You look more like your mother every day, you know.
What's all this nonsense now about your dying a violent death?
Oh, Paul, I'm afraid it's really true. The Black Madonna's never wrong. So I got old hooks up here and revised my will, with everything going to Etienne, that is, during his lifetime. But really, Lamb, it's to be held in trust for you. He can't sell a single solitary thing, only enjoy the income, and when he dies, you'll get everything. Of course, that'll be years and years from now. He's only 26, just your age.
Aunt B, please. Suppose you tell me first who Etienne is.
Paul, lover, surely you know. Etienne's my new husband.
Aunt B, not again. You haven't acquired a seventh.
Sixth, darling. After all, I married that red-headed one twice. You know, the one who used to throw gin bottles at poor Hawkins. What was his name again? Bruce? Yes, that's it. So you see, he only counts once. Etienne's a dear boy, and he doesn't care a hoot about my money. But he's madly in love with me, even threatened suicide if I didn't marry him. Besides, he has such a pretty name, Etienne de Marsigny. So naturally, I had to marry him. So you see, dear, it really was a very reasonable marriage this time. Now, wasn't it?
Of course, Aunt B. Very reasonable. And I know you'll be very happy. You mentioned someone called the Black Madonna? You said she told you...
Well, she didn't tell me exactly. Well, you see, she isn't... Oh, come on. I'll show you. That is the Black Madonna.
Why, it's an old painting of the Virgin and Child. Old, yes, but fairly commonplace, I would think.
Look closer.
On the left cheek of the Madonna, there's a small crescent-shaped scar. It seems to glisten moistly. However did the artist create such an effect? What the devil?
So, you've discovered it already, that the scar is bleeding.
But how can that be? What does it mean?
Shh! There's Etienne. He's been playing golf with friends. I can't stop to explain now. He doesn't like me to talk to anyone about the Black Madonna. Don't linger now. I'll tell you about it later. You can meet Etienne at dinner.
Aunt B seemed absurdly agitated for so little reason. She all but dragged me from the room to the hall, then left me to find my own way. I went up the fantastically grand marble staircase to the suite I always occupied during my rare visits. In the upper hallway, I ran into Minnie, my aunt's personal secretary for many years.
Oh, Paul, I'm so glad you're here. Miss B has been fretting something awful.
I know, Minnie. How long has it been going on?
Just for the last few days. She's been quarreling with him.
Well, I'm sure everything will be all right.
I wouldn't be so sure. Did she tell you about the Black Madonna?
No, not really. She just showed it to me. Before she could say anything, Etienne arrived and she hustled me up here.
So, did you see the scar?
I did. The damn thing was bleeding.
Damn thing might be a more accurate description than you realize.
What do you know about the Black Madonna?
About as much as is known. It came with a pamphlet giving its history. The Black Madonna was commissioned by the Archbishop of the Coptic Cathedral in Cairo in the 14th or 15th century, and it wasn't long before it had acquired the reputation that led to its dire name. The cathedral itself was pillaged again and again, and each time the Black Madonna was stolen, only to end up back at the church. On the first such occasion, one of the vandals must have used it for a target, perhaps in drunken sport, for the painted cheek of the Madonna had been scarred by a sword thrust. It was then that the truly weird aspect of its history began.
Truly weird aspect?
Yes, for it began to be noticed that archbishop after archbishop, titular owners of the painting, were all meeting violent deaths. And in each case, before they died, their deaths were presaged by the bleeding of the scar on the cheek of the Madonna.
Oh, come on. You can't be serious. The bleeding of the scar is probably just some action of heat or humidity on the pigment.
I'm dead serious, Paul. The cops believed it. In terror, they eventually sold the Black Madonna, just to be rid of it. From there, it passed from owner to owner, and each one of them met a violent end. And now, it belongs to your Aunt Bea.
Not saying I buy a word of this, but why in the world would she want to buy a cursed painting?
You know your Aunt Bea. She has a fatal weakness for beautiful baubles that will cause her nothing but pain. Like her husband's. Oh, I apologize, Paul. That was quite inappropriate.
And also quite correct. So he's just like the rest.
You'll find out soon enough. Dinner's just about ready.
I shaved and showered, then went down to dinner. Etienne de Marcigny was exactly as I had pictured him. A slimy serpent with hooded eyes and a furtive manner. The same sort that Aunt Bea had been conned by since the death of her first husband and their young son. I guess women would consider him handsome, and perhaps he was. But I can spot a phony a mile off. Still, I tried to be civil for Aunt Bea's sake. It wasn't easy.
So, Paul, your mother is Bea's sister?
She was, yes.
She passed away 6 years ago, Etienne dear. Now Paul and I are the only family each other have.
What? I don't count? I'm just your husband, after all.
Oh, silly. I mean blood relatives. I've tried to look after Paul, but he insists on going it alone.
You know I appreciate your offers to help, but I'm doing okay.
Oh, you mean with your little Packard dealership in Santa Luisa? Etienne, Paul works around cars all day, and yet his own automobile is perpetually broken down.
Not an ideal advertisement for your company, is it?
Aunt Bea is exaggerating.
So you're telling me that there's nothing wrong with the Clipper?
Just a broken door handle on the passenger side. I'll get it fixed when I go back to Santa Luisa.
Well, it's a shame you can't stay longer, but I suppose it's par for the course. When you have to punch a clock, huh?
You never mentioned what you do for a living, Etienne.
Live, of course, huh?
Live? How? Exactly.
Oh, don't let him fool you, Paul. You should have seen Etienne when I first met him in Monaco. Didn't have 2 francs to rub together.
Now, Bea!
It's all right, dearest. We're family, after all. Now, Etienne wasn't financially able to court me properly. I had to pay for everything, including our wedding. But Etienne was ever so romantic, and very diligent about keeping track of my expenditures on our behalf. Swore he'd repay every penny as soon as he received a sizable inheritance.
Uh-huh.
That's how I knew that this dear young boy loved me for me, not for my bank account. Oh, Paul, darling, you know I've had some bad luck with the mercenary sort in the past, but not this time.
I'm happy for you, Aunt Bea.
Let me tell you how we met in Monaco. It was at Le Grand Casino. You know how I do enjoy a good game of baccarat. Well, I was at the 100-franc table when this exquisite young man offered to give me pointers. And little did he know that I've forgotten more about baccarat than most men ever knew. Anyway.
Aunt Bea rattled on in her usual fanciful style for quite some time. Fortunately, she rarely waited for a reply, so I was able to listen with just half my attention and concentrate on Etienne. If he'd married Aunt Bea only for her money, he seemed to already be repenting his bargain. He sat in sullen silence throughout the meal, his handsome chin sunk on his chest. As soon as dinner had ended, Etienne excused himself, pleading tiredness from the afternoon's golf.
So, what do you think of Etienne?
Aunt Bea, if he makes you happy, that's all that matters.
Well, he doesn't always make the best of first impressions. But Etienne really is a dear boy, and I do hope you'll grow to like him.
When have I ever treated any of your husbands in less than a cordial manner?
You never have, darling. Not even the ones who deserved it.
So, I'm sure that Etienne and I will get along as well as we need to.
Well, I suppose that will have to be good enough.
For you, I will make every effort. Good night, Aunt B.
Good night, Paul, darling. I'm so glad you came. I feel safer now that you're here.
I don't like to remember that because of what happened next. At around 5:30 in the morning, I was awakened by screams of horror coming from the hallway. Minnie!
Oh, Paul! Paul! At the foot of the stairs! It's Miss B!
No.
Aunt B's body lay on the marble floor at the foot of the stairs, her head bent in such a terribly unnatural angle that I knew without a doubt that she was dead. At that moment, all I could think was that she should have met a kinder fate. For life had dealt her so many blows, and she'd always met them with such sprightly gallantry. For her, death might have come peacefully, instead of like a vandal in the night. Then I heard Minnie come down behind me, and I did my best to comfort the heartbroken woman. There to cry for. She's happy now at last.
No.
She's with Steve and little Billy.
I know. I know, Paul.
Good God. I had her sometime during the night, but I was only half awake. She couldn't sleep. She said I was going downstairs for the book. She must have tripped. Oh, B. Why did this have to happen? I just can't believe it.
But even as he wailed in grief, I saw his dark glance go all about the great hall and its furnishings, and it said as plainly as words, "Everything is mine now." Minnie saw it too, for her sobs caught angrily, and the two of us left Etienne to his dramatics to call the authorities and mourn in a quieter, but far more heartfelt fashion. It was while we were waiting for the doctor and undertaker to come that I found myself doing a curious thing. Skeptical as I was, I went into the study just off the patio where the Black Madonna hung. I touched it gingerly, in curiosity at first, then with mounting surprise that made me question for a moment my utter disbelief of the legend. For the scar on the cheek of the Black Madonna was now quite dry. Etienne invited me, not too cordially, to stay on until after the funeral. I can't say I was particularly grateful for his invitation, but I stayed on nonetheless. On the morning after the funeral, Minnie came to my room, and from her conspiratorial manner, I knew there was something on her mind.
Paul, have you ever wondered if maybe Miss B's death was no accident?
What? What do you mean?
I don't think she fell down those stairs. I think she was pushed.
Pushed? But Minnie, who?
Him.
Etienne? I don't like him any more than you do, but that's a very serious accusation to make. Unless you have some proof.
Proof? No, I haven't any proof, at least nothing that would stand up in any court of law. But you know the story of the Black Madonna, how it always forewarns the violent death of the owner.
But Minnie, surely that's just superstition. Just a colorful yarn made up to enhance its value. We don't even know if any of its story is true.
That's not the point. The one thing we do know is that the scar does bleed. And even if the story was embellished, there may be some kernel of truth. Certainly some people believe it. For days before you arrived, Etienne had been fighting with Miss B about the painting. He wanted her to sell the painting, and he was just raving mad because she wouldn't. You know what? I think he'd been planning to do away with Miss B, and he was afraid that the Black Madonna would give him away before he could do it. That Miss B would guess he was meaning to kill her when she saw the Madonna bleeding.
Minnie, even if you're right, and Etienne did kill Aunt B, there isn't any way it can be proved now.
I know. I just needed to talk about it, I guess. I just hate the idea of him getting away with it.
But we don't even know that there's anything for him to get away with.
Don't we? Goodbye, Paul.
Minnie's accusations left me in a quandary. As far as I was concerned, murder was something you read about in the newspapers. I didn't want to think of it happening to someone in my own family. But just suppose Minnie was right. Was Etienne to get off scot-free? Now that suspicion had been planted in my mind, I just couldn't leave without finding out whether Etienne was guilty or innocent. I sincerely hoped he was innocent. But if he wasn't... In my mind, I saw the body of Aunt B, so pathetically huddled there at the foot of the stairs. I would keep seeing it until I knew. And so, I waited until all the servants had left before making my play. I see that all the help is gone.
Yes, I discharged them all. I'm closing up the house and returning to France.
Good. Because I wanted to wait until we were alone to thank you. Nice going, Etienne.
What do you mean?
Getting rid of Aunt B. Something I've often wanted to do myself. But I lacked your nerve.
You can't prove anything.
Oh, proof. As a matter of fact, I wasn't asleep that night. And my door was partly open. I saw you.
You? You saw me push her?
Yes, I saw you. But you don't think I care, do you? After all, she's been a nuisance to me for some time. Always dragging me up here, away from my business, on some harebrained errand. I owe you a debt of gratitude, Etienne. Really. You managed it so neatly. You're a very clever man.
Why, yes. I suppose I am. And why shouldn't I admit it? I haven't anything to fear. After all, even if I told you, it would be your word against mine.
Exactly. How right you are. Shall we have a drink?
Why, that sounds like an excellent idea.
Etienne was right in every respect save one. He did have something to fear. I had to kill him. It was the only way. He had to pay the penalty for murdering Aunt B, and I had to be his judge, jury, and executioner. In the eyes of the world, I would be committing a crime. And for that reason, it had to be the perfect crime, for I didn't want to put my own neck into a noose. I went to my room and considered ways and means. It was much more difficult than one would suppose. Having always led a law-abiding life, murder plots did not suggest themselves readily to my imagination. But then, the solution came, quite literally, to me.
The painting! The Black Madonna is bleeding again!
What? Nonsense!
They just saw it! Come look for yourself! A I was just going through some of these papers when a bit of light, glinting off the Black Madonna, caught my eye. So I walked over to it. The scar on the Madonna's cheek was again, glistening wetly with blood.
Calm down. There's a perfectly rational explanation.
I'm going to die. I'm going to die. Unless, maybe if I go away from here, if I hide from the Black Madonna.
Of course, Etienne, that's what you must do. Leave here immediately. Come, I'll drive you to the station. Terror is a powerful emotion. He wouldn't even wait long enough to pack a bag. He had money. Plenty of money, he said. He could buy whatever he needed when he was safely away. What wits he had were completely addled by fright, for it never even occurred to him to be suspicious of me. He practically dragged me to the car, and soon we were on the treacherous mountain road.
Faster! Faster!
I was glad to oblige, for I knew just the spot I wanted. A hairpin curve, halfway down a long grade. Just beyond the curve, there was a sheer drop of 2,500 feet. We approached the curve at 70 miles an hour, and I applied the brakes, cutting our speed sharply, leaving a long curve skid mark for the police to find later. We were almost at the bend. I straightened the car out of its skid and gunned it, my left hand on the door handle.
Slower! You can't make that turn at this speed!
How right he was! I didn't even try to turn. I headed straight for the white-painted guardrail.
What are you doing? You kill us both! I'm getting out!
But he couldn't, because of the door handle that had been broken for so long. Goodbye, de Marsigny. I'd broken my arm when I jumped, but I hardly felt the pain. And it would serve to make my story more convincing. Slowly, painfully, I walked back to La Casa Encantada to summon the police. But before I made that call, I did one thing. I went in and looked at the Black Madonna. The scar was perfectly dry. My story was airtight. I was going too fast. I jammed on the brakes for the turn. The car skidded on the loose gravel and went out of control. I yelled to de Marsigny to jump, but he couldn't. I'd forgotten that the door handle on his side was broken. No matter how they tried, they couldn't shake my story. A wire to my chief mechanic confirmed my statement that the door handle had been broken when I left to answer Aunt B's summons. Still, they persisted doggedly, regardless of the weight of evidence pointing towards nothing more than negligence. Till finally, I thought they believed me. I'd committed the perfect crime and would never go to the electric chair. But today, I'm not so confident. I must have slipped up someplace, and they'll be coming back for me. For the Black Madonna belongs to me now. And the Black Madonna is bleeding.
So ends The Black Madonna by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes. Tonight's story of Suspense. Suspense is produced by Blue Hours Productions and recorded at Melrose Music in Hollywood, California. Tonight's radio drama was adapted for radio by John C. Alzadek and Dana Perry Hayes from the short story by Harold Lawler. Charles Rahi Chun was Paul. Susan Eisenberg was Aunt B. Rick Fetterman was Etienne de Marsignier. And Catherine Camet was Millie. I'm your host, Damon Crawl. Next week at this time, tune in again for another study in Suspense.
I have have a right to safety. I have a right to education. I have a right to my culture. Kids like me need to know about child rights and earlier age what to do about it.
Today, the Canadian Council of Child and Youth Advocates asks you to make every day a day to stand up for children's rights in your life. If you are a young person who needs the help of an advocate, you can also find the advocate for your own province listed on ccdya.ca.
And you're tuned in to CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Brian McDonald, and that's all the time we have tonight for Scalds Hall. Coming up in a moment, we'll have Canada Post Rock with John. So from all of us here in beautiful Vancouver, please have a safe and happy